Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie. This is The Reason Podcast, and today we're talking with Johan Norberg. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, and he's the author of many books, internationally acclaimed. His latest is Progress, 10 Reasons to Look Forward to the Future. Johan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Nick.
You dedicate the book to Alicia Alexander and Nils Erik. It's your world now. Who are they, and why do they matter?
Well, Alexander and Alicia are my biological children, and Nils Erik is my bonus son. And they're from between 5 and 9 years old. And when I look at progress, when I look at history, I think of all the amazing things that have happened during my lifetime. I think about what life was for my parents when they grew up. And
how old? Can
like
I ask, what year were you born and what year were your parents born?
1973. Okay. That's when I was born. My mother and father in 1940 and 42. And the kind of world that we live in now is something that they couldn't have dreamt of. What we have, would have done with conquering disease and poverty and creating all these opportunities, the kind of freedom in everyday life for at least most people around the world. It's astonishing.
Now,
so
let me ask you that. Okay, I'm sorry. So go ahead. You're thinking of your children.
Exactly, and the kind of progress that I hope that they will inherit and that they will keep this flame of progress burning.
Well, let's and you open the book with an epigram from Benjamin Franklin, among others, who says, you know, that the only regret he has is that he was born too soon, that he won't see the advances of the next 100 years. But you also, throughout the book, you pepper it with you're from Sweden. You with quotes or rather with data from Swedish surveys, British surveys, American surveys, where nobody thinks the world is getting better in their lifetime, with very few exceptions, or at least in the late 20th century, and certainly in this fairly god awful 21st century in many ways. What is it that predisposes us towards discounting or devaluing progress in our lifetime? If you're born in 1973, that means what, Soviet subs were, you know, sinking off the coast of Sweden around that time. But you were in Sweden, for God's sake. Isn't that a paradise? And isn't it still a paradise?
I think that every generation has somewhat doubted that there is real progress going on and that they will see more in the future. The cultural historian Otto Hermann observed that virtually every culture, both past and present, has believed that men and women are not up to the standards of their parents and forebears. So I think this is something that always goes on. We think that the golden age was somewhat in the past, and partly for sort of psychological and personal reasons. When I ask people about when they thought that life was, if this is not the golden age, when was the golden age? When life was good, it was harmonious, and we saw progress. Mm-hmm. Most people happen to mention the era when they grew up for some reason. So my generation think it's the 70s and 80s. The baby boom generation think it's the 50s that they want to return to. So I think that kind of nostalgia is always there. Yeah. And Arthur Herman thought that it was partly because we confuse the slight deterioration in our personal powers. Could be physical, could be sort of psychological, could be that we notice the problems of the world, things that we didn't think of when we were kids,
yeah,
that make us think that things are getting worse.
That's certainly the case with, I think, being a parent for sure, is that you, as a Swede, your parents, I'm sure, were stoic and reserved anyway, but in America, you know, as you get older and you realize, even during a boom period, geez, you know, how many balls were your parents juggling that you knew nothing about until you're in their situation?
That's right. So being a child, you think that life is both exciting because everything is new, but also, hopefully at least, somewhat secure. You got that safety. Then you grow up, then you get kids, and then you begin to think of all the things that could go wrong.
You have traveled the globe, both reporting this book and doing television series and whatnot. Do people in the developing world feel that way? And I'll throw in all four of my grandparents came from Ireland and Italy, from kind of shitty circumstances, actually from objectively shitty circumstances, to what would now I would consider subjectively terrible situations in the teens and 20s and Great Depression in America. But they were never fooling themselves. They were like, no, I'm really glad that I'm here during, 1936, digging basements by hand. This beats the hell out of being a dirt farmer somewhere in southern Italy. Do people in the developing world have that same bias that, are there Rwandans walking around, who are looking back at the civil war there and the genocide and saying, oh, you know what, I wish we could go back to that?
Not really. That's a major difference. If you go to Vietnam and China and you get welcome to a family home, you've got three generations around a table, and they can tell you the whole story of a society, a country going from rags to riches over those generations, from subsistence farming and hunger, basically, into the next generation with some sort of labor-intensive factory production for exports markets. And then the youngest generation getting a decent education, working in the service sector, producing actually kind of high-tech and high-knowledge content goods and services. Then you see progress in another way. It's more real. It's more absolute, because those horrible circumstances are so close by. I think when they are a couple of generations back and you don't listen to those stories at dinner time, then you begin to take progress for granted. And as the old saying goes, he who has satisfied his thirst turns his back to the well. So I think there's a major difference between poor countries rapidly getting richer and already rich countries.
Let's talk about some examples of progress that generally go unacknowledged. In your book, you lay out, I guess it's about 10 chapters, but you talk about food, sanitation, life expectancy, poverty, violence, environment, literacy, freedom, and equality. First, define progress for us. Are you talking mostly about material progress, or what kind of progress are you talking about? And then give a couple of examples of things in, let's say the OECD countries or the developed countries that objectively have been getting better over the past 30, 40, 50 years that people people refuse to believe.
Yeah. Progress, well, material progress is one aspect, or even an effect, I would say, of the basic progress that I'm thinking of, which is really being able to do more things today than you could do yesterday. And that could be in producing knowledge, it could be in producing steel, it could be in producing any kind of life circumstances that we prefer. So it's really something that's more related to a progress in knowledge and how to do things and technology. And then material progress, wealth, that's one of the effects of that kind of progress. The biggest ones in recent years are obviously in poor countries. And I always go back to the story about extreme poverty that has been reduced from something like 37% to less than 10% in 25 years. Every minute that we speak, another 100 people are rise out of extreme poverty.
Define extreme poverty as what? Living on less than $1.25 a day?
Less than $1.90 a day. Okay. Nowadays, yeah. That it's been raised a little bit, that
right.
Threshold.
And
it's
yet
the World Bank,
you talked measure. About in discussing that. I mean, it's amazing, and it is something that even the UN didn't even account for this because it was so unbelievable. Nobody anticipated that many people being raised out of extreme poverty that quickly. But you talk to people or you cite polls in in the U.S. and in other countries. Only 5% of Americans realize that global poverty had been halved in the past 20 years. How do you account for that? I mean, is it just that people are uninformed, or they don't want to believe in progress?
Well, this is the one thing that doesn't get better in the world, our knowledge about progress. You refer to all those studies, and they give us horrible impressions of what people know about this. But just an anecdote that revealed this to me was I produced a graph that kind of summarized many of the graphs in the book, where I wanted to show what had happened to couple of bad things over the last 25 years. Poverty, illiteracy, child mortality, and something else. And they've all been reduced by half or more. And I tweeted this, and then immediately a woman in Britain retweeted it. And with the text, "This graph proves my impression that we're all going to hell in a handcart." So she basically read it upside down, the graph. Right. And I contacted her and asked her, "How did you get the impression that we've doubled all the proportion that lives in these miserable circumstances?" Mm-hmm. And she told me that, "I pay attention to the news. I pay attention to what goes on in the world, and I read about famine, I read about poverty, floods, war, everywhere. And I got the impression then that this is the every normal circumstances around the world, and then that it's getting worse." So I think we're basically being a little bit misinformed by following the news, because bad news sells. The dramatic, shocking things that happen in an instance, that's what we pay attention to. Whereas this slow and steady progress, or even fast and steady progress, rarely makes the news.
So we focus on Ebola and Zika and things like that, which and terrorism. You've mentioned all of these in the book, and we forget. You also cite our mutual friend, my Reason colleague, Ronald Bailey, who recounted, who has a book out called The End of Doom from a year ago, where he opens with an anecdote where he tells his agent, here's the book. And the guy says, or his publisher, and the guy says, "If you had brought me a book saying the world was ending, we'd both be rich men. And instead, you'll get by with this."
So my agent told me the same thing.
Well, hopefully you'll turn that around, or maybe the sales will be really big in Bangladesh. You'll be like a god there, right?
Yeah.
Talk about the what's another example? I mean, so poverty, and you mentioned in passing things like literacy. You also have a phenomenal chart, as somebody who is a generally optimistic, and I follow this stuff, and I'm amazed. I totally am with Ben Franklin in that I wish that I could live another 100 years. But the speed with which child labor is both getting older, so instead of it being 10-year-olds to 13-year-olds, it's 15 to 17-year-olds, but it's still going down. But what are a couple of the other places where just vast progress and better circumstances for many people just go unacknowledged?
Well, the one data point that I think summarizes many others is life expectancy. If that continues to increase around the world, then we're doing something right when it comes to nutrition, when it comes to poverty, education, and so on. And it's increased dramatically, partly because child mortality has been reduced. But now we also reduce many of the old age diseases that we've had. So this life expectancy used to be 31 years around the global average in 1900. Now it's 71. So it's from 31 to 71. It's amazing. And this keeps on going on in the richest countries as well. The best case, the best practice around the world has been increased by 3 months every year for 140 years. And it keeps increasing at that pace
What kind of Swede are you? My understanding of Sweden and of Scandinavia broadly comes from Ingmar Bergman films. And you're like practically happy-go-lucky. You're Pippi Longstocking or something here. Because if you define life itself as a burden, then, by more than doubling it, you're just increasing misery. Maybe we're all existentialists or something.
That's right. But if we're looking at polls, when people talk about their self-reported happiness, it seems like that's increasing as well around the world. Yeah. So if life is miserable, at least it gets a little bit less miserable right now.
So talk a little bit about, because this goes to a larger question about the environment, but certainly about air pollution. You talk a bit about the Great Smog in London, the 1952 Great Smog of London. What was that event, and what kind of lessons can we draw? Because 1952 isn't that long ago, certainly for some of us. What happened, and what can you say more about it?
Oh, that's right. It's not long ago, and many people still think of this as the good old days. But smog in the richest cities on the planet was a regular occurrence. And in 1952, they had this, it had been a few cold days, so the Londoners burned more coal. That's how they stayed warm. And this smoke combined with pollutants and from many industrial processes and vehicles and so on formed an incredibly thick layer over the city. People couldn't see anything. Cars were abandoned and people had to feel their way home, basically, to get back home. I write about this story about the nurse who explained that the smog penetrated clothes and blackened undergarments. And one study estimates that as many as 12,000 people lost their lives during a few days of this great smog in London in that era. And it shows you the kind of pollution, the environmental destruction that went on in those days before we got the kind of wealth that made it possible for us both to appreciate the environment more and also create the technologies that started to clean up the mess that we've created. And this is something that goes on in, especially since the 1970s, when we began to see an environmental movement and then also steps to deal with this, specifically technological ones. If we look at the six leading pollutants in countries like Britain, countries like the United States, they've been reduced since the 1970s by around two-thirds. And these are the kind of pollutants that kill people. Mm-hmm. They entered our lungs and killed us at an early age. So we're making environmental progress as well.
Talk, you mentioned, we became wealthy enough to appreciate the environment. This is, an interesting kind of pressure point for libertarians and free marketers, which is, in the United States, I mean, first off, is there a moment when a country becomes rich enough where it says, I want to live in a better world, a cleaner world, and I am both willing and able to pay for it? How does technology solve these problems? And then what is the role of government in saying, you know what, in the United States, one of the single biggest things that changed air quality here was a switch from leaded gasoline to unleaded gasoline. And I guess that happened a little bit later in most of Europe, but what challenges are there to a kind of hardcore libertarian philosophy of minimal government in terms of pollution control, where it seems that there are absolute cases where collective action, mandatory action, fines, top-down directives actually made the air quality much, much better than it had been?
Yeah. Well, it seems to be an international sort of on average, at least, some kind of environmental Kuznets curve, as the researchers call it. So an inverted U curve. As countries start to get rich, they do more things. So they pollute more, more industry, more transportation, more pollution.
And we're seeing that in the developing world. I mean, people talked about that during the Beijing Olympic Games, people from Western Europe or the developed world, North America would go there and they were like, they couldn't believe how awful the air quality there was.
Right. And that tells you something interesting, that it's Beijing and New Delhi. They are the most polluted places. Mm-hmm. It's not London. It's not New York anymore, the way it used to be. So it is an inverted U curve. Mm-hmm. Pollution increases as countries get richer. But when people have a fairly stable situation, when they realize that they can both send their kids to school and give them enough food to eat, then they start to care about the rivers and the forests as well, and they can afford to do both things. So then suddenly pollution starts decreasing. And so that happens when it comes to many air pollution measures, agricultural wastes. You start to take care of water pollution, landscape degradation, and things like that. So what's the role of government here? Well, from a libertarian perspective, I think it's obvious that much environmental destruction is an intrusion in people's property rights, an intrusion in their health situation. I think as early as Karl Marx, people said that, look, if we had defined property rights everywhere, you couldn't do things like this kind of environmental destruction.
That's the idea that if you're, I don't even, excuse me, I don't know if the River Thames has factories or had factories on it, but you couldn't, if you were a factory owner, you couldn't just dump stuff into the river because you would be polluting somebody else's property and you would be liable for it.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the River Thames, interesting example, because it was declared biologically dead in the 1950s because people just polluted it, because right. There was no one there that could sue those who polluted. Today, it's alive, teeming with fish again. So from a libertarian perspective, I think it's obvious that the government, or at least the courts, they have a role to deal with this. And we start to think of property rights like this when we enter, when we see bigger problems. I mean, it's not a fixed situation, but when we see bigger problems, or when we reach a situation of education and wealth that makes us interested in these matters. But it's difficult to define property rights everywhere, right. And everything, especially when it comes to the atmosphere and our lungs and so on. So in most places, this is being done in a more regulatory way by government authorities, just sort of defining what you can and what you cannot do, and fines. And I think at least, I mean, some kind of polluter pays principles at least imitates what would happen in on a perfect market situation.
Have we created good markets for not markets for pollution, but I guess markets in pollution, where, you know, a collective body, whether it's in a regional authority or a national government, says, you know what, we're not going to put out more than X amount of pollutant. The typical scheme with that is then you give out permits that account for the amount of pollution that is allowed, and anybody who goes over that pays a fine. Is that a good way to do it? Are there smarter ways to do it where in areas where it's very hard to define property rights, but there is a collective action issue where, you know, you want to reduce the output of something? Are there places that have done that better or worse?
I think that this whole situation is a mess, and it's a combination of so many different systems, from different trading platforms to fines to bans, and there's not really any logic to the system. It's more, what did the parties and the special interests here really think that they would benefit from? Various trading mechanisms when it comes to CO2 in Europe, it's partly because many of the emitters knew that then they could get these permissions to pollute for free, and then they could trade them. So it was really, way, a major ripoff. I think that the thing that would imitate some kind of a market situation the best would really be a kind of fee where you pay for the pollution that you create, and it goes to compensating those who are hurt by it. That would be the best one. And then you wouldn't have all those specific permissions. You wouldn't have any kind of arbitrary way of defining who has the most important pollution or anything like that. But as well, there's some sort of arbitrary decisions being made there as well. Where's the fee going to be? How much is it worth?
And I guess it's always better in these instances where collective action is or should be happening, that it would be better for government to set goals, but not necessarily mandate particular types of technology those goals. So to, as best as possible, approximate a market. But then, as you point out, I guess, you know, the people who create the markets are the people who are most invested literally and figuratively in them. So they're always going to give themselves a kind of easier out, right?
That's right. But that's the big lesson, I agree, that the government shouldn't try to pick winners. As bad as they are when it comes to picking winners in industry and business, they're even worse when it comes to sort of picking winners in future technology that'll solve our future problems. So some kind of you're paying for your pollution, and then that gives you an incentive to find something else, something better, look into new technologies and so on, rather than having the government say that now we like ethanol, but tomorrow we don't, now we like these wind farms, now we don't, which is really a sort of a big celebration for special interests, I think.
Talk a little bit about climate change. And this is one of the things where I've been in conversations with people where they'll say, oh, yeah, yeah, I'll give you, you know, more than a doubling of life expectancy since 1900. And yeah, kids don't have to work anymore. And the water, we take clean water for granted through increasing amounts of the world. Sanitation, I mean, your chapter on sanitation might be one of the most eye-opening things I've read in a very long time, because that is something that we totally take for granted for all sorts of reasons. But, you know, they'll be like, yeah, yeah, I'll give you all that, I'll give you all that, and even violence is going down. But you do realize that the world is going to be completely covered in water within, you know, by the time this conversation is over. How do you speak to that kind of apocalypticism?
Yeah, I think it's important to note is that as we've begun to, I think global warming is happening, and I think that mankind is partly to blame for this as well. But the outcomes varies dramatically between different scenarios, because we've only got sort of bad computer models that are to try to find any kind of solution here. The worst damage, what we do know, occurs in poor countries, partly as a result of their poverty. When we look at what the UN Climate Change Panel says, we see the destruction that will take place from more things like new diseases coming, tropic diseases spreading, perhaps more floods, perhaps a higher water level, and so on. Those things are not apocalyptic if you compare it to many of the things that we've experienced over the last 100 years or so. They are apocalyptic in certain places, poor countries where they don't have the technology to deal with it. So that's why I think that the whole attempt to disprove progress by saying that, look, things could go wrong when it comes to global warming is really turning things on its head. It's the other way around. Mm. This could be incredibly dangerous for poor countries if they do not see any kind of progress in the future as well.
So it's kind of like, I mean, Bangladesh and South Florida have similar weather patterns. They're not exactly the same, but the idea is to turn Bangladesh, make it as wealthy as Palm Beach, Florida, wealthy area, as opposed to try and, you know, stop the type of economic activity that allows Bangladesh to rise up and then not really be able to adapt to climate change.
That's right. That's exactly the case. And if we have a stable, decent economic growth around the world in the next 100 years, something around 2% a year, then we'll be some sort of seven times richer by the end of it. The kind of knowledge, the kind of technology that will be at our disposal, both in dealing with climate change in itself. I mean, we already have ways of getting carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. We could do that as well. But also dealing with the kind of changes that will take place in any case, that will take place as a result of global warming, but also because of other natural changes in our environment will be sort of by an order of magnitude different from what we have right now. So we need that progress. We need that kind of economic progress to deal with it. Now, I can also see that we are developing technologies that will deal with this, just like we did with other pollutants, just like we did when it comes to water pollution and things like that. We have that in laboratories, but also in practice, things that do not emit greenhouse gases to that extent. Fracking has resulted in much less carbon dioxide in the U.S. in the last few years. We can see on the drawing board, we have everything from new generations of nuclear power to sort of new kind of biofuels that are not the kind of old ethanol, but more like algae and so on, that would really create enormous power and actually help us with dealing with global warming. Those are things that are, and I think solar power is something that's, I mean, from many libertarians have complained about it because we've seen so much subsidies going into this. And that's true, because what happens when the government steps in and begins to subsidize is that they subsidize the production of the kind of solar panels that we have today to benefit the businesses that are around today. And that has merely sort of benefited certain interests, and it hasn't really made much difference. But with the materials of tomorrow, graphene, for example, if we can make that work, we can have solar panels basically in everywhere. It's an unbelievably thin and flexible material that doesn't corrode, that conducts heat and electricity very efficiently. That could drastically change the economics of solar power. We could have those, have it on our buildings, on the roads, everywhere. Or we could have solar power in the in space, where the sun always shines, rather than in Germany, where it doesn't. So those things are being developed right now. And with the kind of wealth that we'll have in the future, two things are the result of that. More purchasing power in more places so that they could use these technologies, and more technological development means that this will come down in price dramatically.
Well, let's. You are listening to the Reason Podcast. I'm Nick Gillespie. We're talking with Johan Norberg. He is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, and his latest book, which I urge everyone to read, is Progress, 10 Reasons to Look Forward to the Future. Pick it up on a Monday, and you'll be done with it by the afternoon, because it's both that compelling and that convincing. Johan, what is responsible for progress? In the book, you kind of sketch out three main causes. Why don't we go through those? One is the growth of science and knowledge. One is the growth of trade and cooperation. And then you add, which I found particularly interesting, the freedom to act on this. So talk a little bit about how the growth of science and knowledge, you know, helps propel progress.
Yeah, this is really a very Hayekian process, I think.
And now we're talking about Friedrich Hayek, not Salma Hayek.
That's right. And I think that the basic point, and that's something that we notice when we look at the growth of science and new innovations, is that basically no one expected what would happen anywhere. And often those who were the main achievers didn't really expect it either, or at least not the kind of impact that it would have on our lives.
What's an example of that? Do you have a ready anecdote for that one?
Well, I mean, Wilbur Norville Wright said early in 1900 that no, man will probably never be able to fly with heavier than air machines themselves, but they took the chance and experimented with it a little bit and tried it out. So we have the same kind of situation when we look at a few of the people who worked on creating better sort of industrial artificial fertilizer, the Haber-Bosch process, which is probably trying to get ammonia from the atmosphere, basically, which resulted in saving hundreds of millions of lives in the last 100 years.
Yeah, your words on in the book about Norman Borlaug, the father of the Green Revolution and Nobel Peace Prize winner for creating drought-resistant crops that literally saved billions of people from starvation in the post-war era, are stunning on that. And a lot of it comes down to a much better fertilizer.
That's right. And the thing is that no one thought that this was going to happen. Well, Borlaug, he was fairly convinced to, but everybody fought him on every step of the way, basically. Because why devote resources to some sort of strange future that we don't even know is going to happen when we have problems here?
Talk about trade and cooperation, too, because these kind of go hand in hand, right? I mean, you have the growth of knowledge, of science, of technological innovation, if you can't, if you can't work with other people, everything stops. So how does trade and cooperation amplify the growth of science and knowledge?
Yeah, if progress happens in this Hayekian, this Friedrich Hayekian process, where basically, we don't know what's going to happen. But if we have 1 million experiments and 1 million different ideas, and we're allowed to try them out, test them out on a small scale, then a few of them will be interesting and have great potential. And they'll expand and people will imitate that and do it on a wider scale. Now, we need...
And also, if they're catastrophic, we can just drop them, right?
That's right. Yep. If Mao Zedong has an idea on how to change agriculture, the result is that 30 million people die. If Norman Borlaug has an idea, and if he would have failed, the result would have been a couple of $1 million lost, but not much more than that. Right. So we need both this kind of experiment, but also this decentralization, radical decentralization, where people are responsible for their own choices and also reap the rewards or also pay the price for failing. So that's, I think, one of the most powerful arguments in favor of a decentralized market regime rather than centralized authoritarian government.
And that's one of the places also where, you know, certainly since World War II, we have seen often unacknowledged gains, literally gains from trade, where, you know, international tariffs all over the place are much lower in general than they were. It's made a lot of things cheaper. I mean, all I know, certainly in this presidential election, all we hear about is how, you know, we're getting too many cheap imports. We've got to change everything. Whereas, you know, that is literally one way to look at it, and it's not a particularly good way to look at it. So it's another form of unacknowledged progress, the fact that goods and literally people can move around more freely than they did 50, 100 years ago.
Exactly. And we need that kind of trade and specialization if we are to benefit from this increase in scientific knowledge and technological progress that takes place in other places. Mm-hmm. If we don't have that, I mean, what trade really means is that we benefit from more knowledge than we used to. If everybody works in subsistence agriculture, everybody basically has the same knowledge about the crops, about irrigation, about how to do that. The moment people start to specialize, they can get more knowledge, they can go further, they can invest in more technology in what they're doing, and then someone produces the food, someone else produces the computer. So we benefit, we create, we accumulate more knowledge around the world. That's
I can remember, and this has got to be more than a decade ago, talking with you about an earlier book, In Defense of Global Capitalism, which I also highly recommend and still refer to on a regular basis. We were talking about the effects of globalization, which, of course, in the late 90s was, you know, the great boogeyman that was going to destroy everything that was pure and beautiful and sweet smelling about the world, particularly poor countries. You mentioned that, you know, the effects of trade are actually, it's not simply, you know, that you get a new DVD player somewhere or you get medicine in a poor country, but that it changes the way people think about what their life possibilities are. And it seems to me that you've come back to that in this, when you talk about not only the growth of science and knowledge and trade and cooperation, but the freedom to act on this. We live in a world now where there are parts of the world where, you know, people, women will get killed for walking down the street wearing, you know, not being covered up, other places where it's illegal to say certain things, et cetera. Do we have increasing amounts of freedom to act on the knowledge that we have?
Yeah, that in a way that depends on where you live, because overall, freedom, democracy, free markets have made tremendous progress over the last, well, since I was born in 1973, in both when it comes to sort of the number of, the proportion of free countries, politically free, has increased from something like 25% to 64% today. When you look at the economic freedom of the world as measured by the Fraser Institute, if you had the average of the world from 1980 coming back to our world today, it would be, I think, the 151st freest country out of 158 measured, something like that, below Zimbabwe in economic freedom. Yeah. So it shows you that the Freedom to Act has increased in many places. And even, I mean, there's a lot of disappointment about this because we can see that all Russia slid back into despotism, China is still a dictatorship, and so on. And that's all true. But at the same time, the rise of communications technology, influences from other places, education has meant that even being not free is not what it used to be. The average Chinese today is not as oppressed as they were 30 years ago, because now they can dress in the way they want to, live almost anywhere, they can travel abroad, they can belong to at least some of the major world religions if they want to, they can be gay without ending up in a labor camp, and they follow world news, they follow what goes on in other places, so it widens, broadens their horizon, at least.
Talk then about what are the barriers to continued progress? Because, I agree with you completely. And I think anybody who reads your book or follows your work in general with an open mind will have to concede, the world is a better place since Johann was born. We're not going to attribute it completely to you, but you have some small role to play in that. But seriously, that things are better overall. But so what are the barriers to continued progress? We started off talking about how people seem to take progress for granted, and it's true. And the longer you get to exist in a kind of happy middle or wealthy society, you know, it seems that people tend to lose sight of how wealth is produced and how progress happens. So what are the barriers to continued progress?
In a way, my response is the same as Matt Ridley's, my British colleague in optimism, author of The Rational Optimist, who said that it's superstition and bureaucracy. That's the kind of thing that could ruin our progress, because superstition can obstruct the accumulation of knowledge, and bureaucracy can stop us from applying that knowledge, stop us from being free to experiment with this knowledge. And we can see that in various forms, everything from sort of radical Islamists who want to stop girls from getting an education, to our sort of opposition to vaccines because we have all these ideas about how it'll create autism or is it sort of a conspiracy against people. But also bureaucracy, because we have always those attempts to block progress because it threatens the old powers. And this could be everything from opposition to genetically modified organisms in Europe, where it's incredibly difficult to get anything done. And the longer time you've had that in place, the more you also build up special interests that are in favor of this. Because now if we open our borders to trade with this from the US, for example, well, then many of our farmers would suffer tremendously. So superstition and bureaucracy. But I would also add another one, and that's complacency. Or at least some sort of a fear that stops us from venturing out further into more progress. And I think that this election season's opposition to free trade and to more reforms is unfortunately a brilliant example of this.
Talk about it in a European context as well. I assumed you were talking about an American context where both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are starkly protectionist. But in the book, you also mention how nationalism or nativism is a better term, and it's the one that you use throughout Europe, in parts of in Scandinavia, in Central Europe, in Russia, certainly, as well as places like France and Germany. What's that pushback coming from? What is driving that?
I think that one of the reasons why I wrote this book is to say, look, it's not that everything is great and it'll continue that way, but it's a way of saying, don't take this progress for granted, because it's amazing. It's astonishing historically that we've accomplished this, but don't take it for granted, because we could screw up dramatically as well. And especially if they do not believe in human progress, if they think that when people are left to their own devices, they'll create chaos and just sort of ruin things, then we'll see this temptation to look for a strong man or a strong woman or a strong big government that'll take care of us and protect us from this globalized mess.
And there does seem to be a fear that is palpable throughout, again, using the broadly defined terms of the OECD countries or the developed world, that we have a certain storehouse of goods. And the more we let other people in, whether they're Mexicans in America or Syrian refugees in parts of Europe, that all they're going to do, we'll have less for ourselves. The idea that you can actually increase the storehouse has gone missing because people, I guess, don't appreciate the progress and the developing amount of resources that we have.
That's exactly the case. Something interesting happened between my book, In Defense of Global Capitalism, some 13 years ago, and this book now, because they both basically tell the same story about what people can do when they are free. But at that time, people said that, look, if we're all free, we have free trade, globalization, capitalism, poor countries will suffer. Sure, we will benefit in rich countries, but the poor countries will suffer. And I told them that, oh, look, the world is not a zero-sum game. We will benefit and they will benefit. And that was the case. They benefited tremendously. And now everybody buys that because they can see the progress in China and in India. They've seen that we've reduced poverty. At least many people can see that they made a lot of economic progress. And then people say, oh gosh, they are winning out. Then we must be losing, because they basically still think that the world economy is a zero-sum game. If someone wins out, then someone else must lose out. And if they didn't, well, then it must be our turn to lose now.
Well, you had said, you know, basically if economic growth, global economic growth averages about 2%, you know, wealth will continue to really grow in exponential terms, essentially. In the United States, from about the end of World War II till about 2000, we averaged around 3% economic growth a year, meaning, you know, the economy expanded at that rate. Since then, it's been a 2% or lower. Do you think, are people sensing, maybe without knowing it, or are they right, but is it that the kind of bonus that is going on through a more integrated, globally connected world is that some of the growth that would have been going to the U.S. is now ending up in places like China or India or parts of Africa, which is just exploding with economic growth? And if so, is it not that we're facing fear of progress, but it's that we just want to hang on to what we have and screw the rest of the world? Or is it fundamentally wrong to think that China or India or Africa or wherever is growing at the United States' expense?
It's the problem is this fixed pie mistake that people think that their growth is some kind of threat to us. On the contrary, it means more people, hundreds of millions more people, can now put their work and their thoughts and their brains to the world's disposal. And they will only benefit if they can produce goods, services, knowledge, technology that we will benefit from. The interesting thing when you look at this era of globalization is that, yes, a country's increase in social and health indicators and so on is correlated to a country's economic rate of growth, but it's even more correlated to the world's growth, which means that it doesn't really matter who comes up with a new business model or the new brilliant drug that'll save us or the next technological innovation, because we will all be able to use it and it'll enhance our living standards and our productivity as well if we are open to it. It's difficult to sort of create a vaccine against measles or antibiotics or the internet or something like that. But when it has happened, then everybody can use it around the world. So this is really a great bonus to us that so many other people around the world at last have a chance of doing things. But it's only a benefit if we are open to it. If we engage in international trade, investments, if we travel across borders, if we communicate across borders, and if we're allowed to use those technologies that they produce as well. And this is my great fear. When people are fearful about the world because they believe in the zero-sum game and because they've been taught partly by the breaking news stories that everything is awful in the world, we must somehow protect what we've got, then there's always this temptation to block our borders, to build those tariffs and so on. And history shows us that the only ones who lose out from that is ourselves, because then someone else will use those things and implement that knowledge, but we won't.
And in this sense, you know, one of the chapter towards the end of, you know, what do we do from here is fantastic. In Progress, 10 Reasons to Look Forward to the Future. Is Japan, and there you go through various instances where societies, whether it was the Arab world, the Middle Eastern world, that just kind of turned its back on science and progress when it was vastly ahead of what became known as the West. You talked about China and the distinctions between dynasties where, you know, when you start burning your boats and turning inwards, it's over. Is Japan kind of the leading indicator of this, where it's a country that is very protectionist, is aging rapidly, but doesn't want to allow immigrants? Is Japan kind of the canary in the coal mine for developed nations that we should be focused on and basically do everything different than they're doing?
Yeah, in a way, they've been stuck for a very long time now in this kind of fear, in a fear of international trade, of immigration, and of creative destruction. So they've basically tried to keep everything in place and subsidize the old solutions and the old businesses and the old
banks. It wasn't that long ago, and I don't know if this was the case in Europe, but in the 80s, everybody in America was told, you know, learn Japanese and do whatever Japanese businesses are doing, because they have ascended on top of the market. They will never fail. They have perfected everything. And almost as soon as everybody switched their majors to Japanese, it all went belly up for them. So they were I'm thinking of Schumpeter. They were kind of first to ripen, and they're the first to rot.
I think that, I mean, Japan still has very successful multinational companies, and they are the ones that are exposed to international competition. So they have to be brilliant and keep on making progress. And they also implement a lot of that in Japanese society. It's not the way it was 20 years ago. They still make that kind of progress. But at the same time, there's always that risk. In social psychology, they talk about the risk of an authoritarian reflex. When you think that the world is falling apart, or you somehow have to protect what you've got, and then you become more authoritarian, or at least a less loaded term, somewhat more conservative in the way that you're not willing to risk things for more progress. You're not willing to open markets and implement new technology and so on. And when you do that, of course, you'll see more stagnation. And with that stagnation comes more fear, and more fear of free trade, of globalization, of technological progress. So there's always this risk that fear will become a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I think this nationalist and populist backlash in Europe and in the US right now is some kind of a symptom of this. And it's a very risky moment, I think. And this is exactly the moment when we have to talk about what people can do when they're free.
Well, thank you. We will leave it there. We've been talking with Johan Norberg. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, and he's a Swedish-based author, most recently of the fantastic book Progress, 10 Reasons to Look Forward to the Future. And Johan, despite being a Swede, a sad and melancholy race, maybe not as bad as the Danes, but up there, I want to thank you for taking time from playing chess with death to kind of to lay out the case for how much progress has been going on, because you talk about a kind of authoritarianism and nationalism and nativism and fear as a symptom. And it's a symptom of a complete misunderstanding of the world and the potential for the world. And I think your book then is kind of like penicillin for the 21st century. And I hope that it is widely read and very influential in debates. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Nick.
For Reasons Podcast, I'm Nick Gillespie. Please look for us at iTunes, SoundCloud, at Reason.com. We've got RSS feeds. Review, rate, and tell us what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong. Go to Reason.com/podcast. Again, this hour, we've been talking with Johan Norberg, senior fellow at the Cato Institute, author of Progress, 10 Reasons to Look Forward to the Future. Thanks for listening.